Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our nation's 30th president, Calvin Coolidge. We talk about this hour with the author of an extremely complete biography of the president. Coolidge is the name of the book, and the author is Amity Schlaes. Amity has been a syndicated columnist for a number of years. She directs the economic project at the Bush Center, the 4% Growth Project, teaches economics of the 1930s in the MBA program at NYU, and is a former member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. She is the author of The Forgotten Man, a national bestseller, The History of the Great Depression, The Greedy Hand, about America's experience with its tax code, and also Germany, The Empire Within, about German national identity. She is a trustee of the Calvin Coolidge Memorial Foundation and writes in the intro to the book, "The overlooking of Coolidge is a shame, for full knowledge of this president enriches the study of all presidents. Without seeing Coolidge in the ranks, we cannot entirely appreciate the office." And so we'll learn a great deal about Calvin Coolidge this hour of our program, and welcome your phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to leave a message there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. So that's the story. And we're just trying to make a phone connection. We've heard from her, but we're just getting a hold of her right now. So hold on. We'll be with her momentarily. It was an interesting time in American history when he was president. We'll learn about a major police strike in Boston that he believed brought him to national prominence. He was a man, at least the legend goes, of very few words, Silent Cal. You'll remember the story of the woman who bet him that she could get him to say more than two words, and he said, "You lose." And there are a lot of other stories, but we don't know very much about him, and so thus this hour. And we do have Amity with us at this moment. Hello, Amity. Thank you very much for being with us. Oh, I got the wrong line. There we go. Hello, Amity. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello.
Yeah, great to have you here. You say at one part late in the book that, and I thought we would start here, there is an idea that Calvin Coolidge remains obscure because of a love story and two principles. And I thought that's an intriguing sentence, and I want you to talk more about that.
Well, that's a wonderful way to start. Thank you for that. This book has plenty of love in it for a book about a cold man.
Mm-hmm.
The love story was the love story between the president and his wife. I study presidents a lot. I'm now affiliated with a presidential center. It's hard to be president. It's hard to be the first lady because there's so much to do. You can't connect with one another. The first lady and the president tend to have two entourages, and then there's sort of your court and my court, right?
Right.
And the Coolidges had a fight. President Coolidge was a jealous man for Cold Fish, and Mrs. Coolidge, Grace Coolidge, was a beautiful lady, one of the most beautiful first ladies, and she liked sports. And she went walking one day with her Secret Service man, Mr. Haley, and they got lost in the wilds of South Dakota, and the president worried that they might be hurt, and he got angry. And when the pair came back, Mr. President Coolidge fired the Secret Service man, Mr. Haley, and he transferred him away from this special job. And Mrs. Coolidge, of course, was very angry because this was one of her companions while the president was away. I don't think we know that there was anything really secret about it. It was just the way it was, and that's the way it is in the presidency, you know. And there was a distance between them, and I chronicled that through their letters, which I discovered in various places, including at the Coolidge Archive and the Forbes Library. President Coolidge wanted to make it up to Mrs. Coolidge, the time away, and that was one reason he retired. And how do we know the extent of his love? Most presidents have to raise money at the end of their presidency and after for their library. Coolidge raised a lot of money. He got all his friends together, including Clarence Barron, the editor of the Wall Street Journal, And the men raised $2 million, which was a lot of money.
That is a lot of money.
Oh, my goodness. And but President Coolidge didn't give this to his library. Oh, no. He gave it to his wife's favorite charity, which happened to be the Clark School for the Deaf in Northampton.
Where she taught, right?
Where she had taught. That was her career, right? So he honored her career and her commitment, and he participated in it enthusiastically as first husband. And that was a special gift, but it's one reason there wasn't a lot of money for all the Coolidge archives. There wasn't a government law at that time, and the principle at issue, at least the first one, is federalism. President Coolidge didn't really think that the federal government should pay for a thing like a library. There was no law, and he wouldn't have liked it. He thought the state might do something, the state of Massachusetts, or it may be the town, and he didn't even like the idea of the state doing it because it was the people's money. He didn't like to spend the people's money very much. So as a result, the Coolidge Archive is kind of dispersed, some of it in the Library of Congress, beautiful material there, some at the Forbes Library, to which President Coolidge did give his material in Northampton, Massachusetts, where he had practiced law, and some in Vermont, where he was born.
Tell the story, because it says something about money and something about the relationship with his wife and the possible jealousy. I think that most of us, and I don't know where we have seen this picture, but it is a pretty famous picture of Grace Coolidge in this gorgeous red long dress with a white collie next to her. And he had problems with the dress, didn't he?
Yes. I want to say again, all first ladies are beautiful. Mrs. Coolidge was among the most beautiful. She had this olive. Mrs. Harding, who was before her, looked good in a certain color blue, and they called that Harding blue. Well, Mrs. Coolidge looked good in every color. It's hard to find a color she didn't look good in. She had olive skin, and just white looked good, green looked good, pink looked good, deep pink looked good. It just didn't stop. People were envious of her. Red looked fabulous. President Coolidge was jealous of her. He was protective of her, and there was, a painter painted this picture of Mrs. Coolidge with one of their white collies. She wore red. The collie was white. It was quite striking. Coolidge came along and saw it all, and he said, "That red dress, it's just too much. You know, can't it be another color?" And they said, "Oh, no, no, the painting has to have her in a red dress to set off the collie, who's white."
And of course.
Of course, right? And he said, "Well, let's just paint the collie red then, put her in white." And when Mrs. Coolidge mourned the terrible event in the White House, the loss of their son, Calvin Jr., she wore white, not black. President Coolidge didn't want her to wear black. And this reflected also her deep faith. She's extremely spiritual. So she put her Calvin Jr.'s Bible with him, you know, when his casket went into the ground. She addressed her incredible grief with incredible faith.
Would you say that, is it fair to say that money was an obsession with Calvin Coolidge?
Money was an obsession, but as a means to an end, not because he was materialist. He was scarcely materialist, except when it came to Grace, who had very beautiful clothes, provided by one of their best political patrons, in a correct way, Mr. Stearns. But he wasn't really material. He said he wasn't material. He said, I don't budget. I don't have a text in front of me, but he said things to the effect that I don't budget for the sake of budgeting. I budget so that people can be free. Things of the spirit. The Bible is everywhere in his talk. Things of the spirit. It concerned him more than material life. The Coolidges themselves lived extremely modestly. As we know, they didn't buy a house. They rented half a two-family. This earned the disdain of some other politicians, such as the very snobby Henry Cabot Lodge from Boston, who was used to living high. They were just comfortable where they were. They knew that the family mattered more. They didn't really have a car until towards the end. They were suspicious of luxury and that it might compromise them, but they wanted other people to have the freedom to use their money. Coolidge thought it was wrong to tax, not just that it was impractical, as today's economists, you know, will make an argument. You change the tax rate, people will behave thus and thus, if people were, as if people are rabbits, right? Oh, give the rabbit a stimulus carrot and he will, you know, go through the little door. That's sort of the way we run economics. Now, in those days, Coolidge said, well, if you cut taxes, rates, for example, people might conduct more business, but they will also, more important, be free. It is wrong for the president to, or Washington, or a state to load too much taxes on an individual. It's a moral wrong. And I have an article actually in Imprimis this month, which is the wonderful periodical of Hillsdale in Michigan, the moral case for tax cuts, which is different from the behaviorist or scientific case. Cool, they made both.
Mm-hmm.
But the moral aspect was his.
You write that in a speech in December of 1923, Calvin Coolidge staked his presidency on tax cuts. So it's worthy of some discussion here, particularly because we're debating the same issues in 2013. What was the plan that he came up with for tax cuts, and why was he willing to stake his presidency on this issue?
Because he was willing to stake his presidency on this issue because he believed that the worst aspect of the war was the burden it placed on every man, whether that was service, that's hard. You want to end that, being a soldier, dying, or being wounded for your country. So many were wounded. But the other was the cost. The cost never went away. The country came out of the war with debt and levied heavy taxes. As we know, taxes were over 70%, the top tax rate, subsequent to World War I. So Coolidge wanted to lift the burden. And he staked his presidency because he wanted to ensure that when America was not in war, it would not have a big government. That would be the normal way, to use the phrase they used. In war, big government, rest of time, no big government. Revert to the norm. And Harding used that phrase, too. And if the perpetual crisis state of war, if the crisis state of war became perpetual, that the country was always in crisis and therefore always had a big government, Coolidge reckoned that would be defeat. So it's very like now, are we in that certain characters on the political stage said crisis, crisis, crisis of both parties, and certain other characters said don't say crisis, because crisis causes big spending in big government and allows for advances by government, and maybe those advances are not worthy. So you think of, for example, and Coolidge didn't, but because he couldn't, but of the statement by Rahm Emanuel where he said a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. Coolidge knew that was true. That is to say that politicians would use a crisis in one area as an excuse to promote policy in another area. Well, because of World War I, we had to have hydropower at home, just as now, well, because of the financial crisis, we might have to have Obamacare here. Well, not everyone agreed with that, didn't see the logic of it. So there he was, and the tax cuts were the clearest way to pull the government back to normal.
And where did the cuts fall, Amity? Where were they?
Well, this is a very interesting story. Mellon, the Treasury Secretary, Andrew Mellon, he was in charge. Remember, Coolidge believed in delegation as a president, mm-hmm. also different. He did not see himself as a domestic commander-in-chief. This is up to Andy, right? Up to the Treasury. And the Treasury had this Andy had thought a lot about taxes. He was a big businessman, sort of commensurate in stature to Warren Buffett today, or maybe Sergey Brin and Warren Buffett combined, or something like that, or Greenspan. Mellon was a mighty force. Mm-hmm. He had basically industrialized America through venture capital, through the introduction capitalization of the aluminum business, through his railroad work and so on. And Mellon thought saw from railroading that if you cut the toll, the cost of railroading, the traffic increased. He said you should charge in toll and freight what the traffic will bear. You know, scientifically, if you lowered the rate, more people use your railroad. And he carried that principle over to the government. He said, the taxes are too high. There's less traffic. There's less commerce because our taxes are too high. What if we lower the tax? We might get more money. That's what they called scientific taxation. And I want to mention that was part of the progressive culture that liked that idea, because the progressives wanted scientific government. It wasn't a right-wing idea at that time. And Coolidge was skeptical about this idea for two reasons initially. One is he wasn't sure it would work. As a cautious man, well, Mellon says if you cut the rate, you'll get more money. I'm not so sure. You know, in my experience, you better be on the safe side, right? And the other was he feared very, very much, too, that Mellon might be right. Mellon knew more. This is the president who respected his cabinet. Clearly, Mellon knew a lot. He was just a governor, and Mellon was a great magnate. Well, if Mellon was right, they would bring in money by cutting rates, and then what? Oh, Congress would spend that money and make government bigger. Can you imagine? But Coolidge went along because this was his man, and for the moral reason we discussed before, because he thought cutting rates was good for individuals. They would have less of a burden. They went on and saw what happened. It was a long tax campaign, and Coolidge stood by Mellon during many humiliating moments. The upshot of it, though, was that Mellon's tax experiment worked. They got more money than they thought they would with lower rates. And it, there's chapters where I describe Coolidge discovering this data. Oh, my gosh. He looked down. Oh, it's like Fidelity. It went up. Do I approve of that? Right? Today, the stock market is very high. Maybe somebody's looking at his pension and seeing it went up. Is that real? That was sort of the way Coolidge looked at the data that Mellon gave him. But indeed, the government did get more money when they cut the rate to 25%, the top marginal rate in the Coolidge Coolidge achievement was 25%, which is a greater achievement in terms of rate cutting, you know, of number you get down to, at least, than Reagan. Wow, 25. And something interesting also happened, which is that the rich paid more taxes. If you go back to the statistics of income of the 1920s, which are the technical documents, you will see the rich paid more taxes. Why? Because they were running away less from the government because the rate was more reasonable.
Mm-hmm. And so, you mentioned Reagan. Reagan took down whose picture and put up Calvin Coolidge's picture in the cabinet room, right?
Yes, and some friend or other of Reagan came up to me at one time, and I wish that person would materialize so I could identify him on the radio, and said that he visited Reagan in the hospital subsequent to Reagan's being shot, and Reagan was reading a Coolidge bio.
Really?
And counting by Claude Fees. There are a number of wonderful Coolidge bios before mine, by Claude Fees. And that Coolidge bio, well, anyway, Reagan was reading it carefully, trying to figure out how many times they cut taxes. Well, they cut taxes three or four times, maybe five, they, including Harding. And Reagan wondered if he could achieve that there in his hospital bed. Yes, of course, Reagan studied Coolidge, and not just for taxes.
Mm-hmm. Normalcy, you mentioned normalcy and Harding and Coolidge running on this normalcy kind of platform. What did that word mean, normalcy?
Well, thank you for asking this. I'm enjoying this interview because you do seem to care about the book, and I care about the book because it's mine, but also because I care about these people and these concepts coming to light. Today we talk a lot about less uncertainty in the market, the slow recovery of recent years, or specifically less uncertainty vis-a-vis hiring. You may be listening and wondering whether you should hire someone because you're not clear on what the healthcare law, or the tax rate, or the inflation rate will be, and therefore you are not hiring. That uncertainty that slows, clogs recovery, they were quite concerned with that then too. They called it, they said, we want normalcy, by which they did not mean what it says in the Cliff Notes or something, that normalcy was for make America like a bunch of anti-intellectual cogs. They didn't mean that. They said, we want a normal environment so people can have fun, start companies, and get about their business, buy houses. That is, they wanted less uncertainty. That was what normalcy meant. It was the logo of the 1920 campaign.
Let's welcome phone calls. We have a lot to talk about. It's a whole life, and he was president after all. Calvin Coolidge, the book is Coolidge. Amity Schles is the author of the book, and she is our guest this hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Calvin Coolidge, one of those presidents we tend to not know a whole lot about. The Capitol in Washington really has no significant memorial to Calvin Coolidge. There is no presidential library. Our guest got information from a variety of sources. I guess he is best known to be the president to shrink the size and reach of government. It was an interesting time because you'll remember what happened after Coolidge decided not to run again in 1928. What happened? Was there anything, I wonder, and we'll ask Amity this, that Coolidge could have done to prevent? Did he contribute in any way to the great downfall, economic downfall? What were his thoughts about that when Hoover took over? We'll talk about that and more. So join us. Oh, there go the phone lines. You love talking about presidents. So do I. We'll return and take your calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Calvin Coolidge this hour with the author of Coolidge, Amity Schles. Our first call is Dick in Waukesha. Hi, Dick.
I told the host I had a story, but I have two quickies on the about his silence. He liked to fish for trout, and he and Grace were vacationing in the Brule country. And actually, they were staying in Brule. And one of the weekends, he went to church. She was not able to go. And when he came back home, she asked him what the minister preached on. Sin, he said. What did he say about it? He was against it.
Yeah.
And the other one was a story in Yankee Magazine some years ago. A woman had sent in, and when she was a little girl, 7, 8 years old, maybe she and her family went to Washington, D.C., and they took the White House tour. And it's a big line that looped around the big room, and she noticed that Cal was speaking to the people he shook hands with, and she wondered what he'd say when she got around that to that point where he shook hands with her. And he shook her hand and said, "Move along."
Oh. Well, yep. Well, thank you for those stories. There are a number of stories about his silence. In order to tell a Coolidge story, you need to give space and narrative, silence, which we're not used to on the radio. He
right.
had his own rhythm. An example of one such story I'm thinking of is that he would even punish people if they talked too much. He tried to train people to talk less. And an example was a lady came to make a pitch for an ambassador. People come. An ambassador's slot in London. People come to the White House all the time to make a pitch, right? That's what they come for. The lady got there and she yapped away for quite a long time about her candidate, and he wanted her to leave, but she wouldn't. And finally, she summed up and said, "I'm sure, of course, before I even arrived, you were aware of all this candidate's merits for the job of ambassador to London." And the president said, "Yes, less now." That is, after your and did Coolidge do this because he was from New England and horrible? No, he was not horrible. He did it. There was a method to his silence, and also a goal. The goal was he didn't want to give away things that belonged to the people, to various mendicants, and he knew that the less he talked, the faster they would leave. And he told that to other politicians. He wasn't unkind. He was trying to both be democratic, to receive all these audiences. I don't know if you ever read the books about other presidents, but they got exhausted by, enduring these sessions at the White House. Hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people, hands to shake and so on. And he did that very patiently. So there was the receiving obligation, but there was also his obligation to the voter not to give away money that belonged to the voter. And he was always balancing these two claims upon the presidency.
Dick, thanks for the call. Here's an email from Jeff in Madison. It's lengthy. We can't read all of it, but he's obviously no fan of Calvin Coolidge, so take whatever part you'd like to respond to. Jeff writes, Calvin Coolidge ranks low as a president. It's a ranking that should remain. His attitude was the business of America is business. We would have been better served by Senator Bob La Follette, who ran against him in 1924. In immigration, he tightened quotas in 1924, choked off new blood from Europe. He was anti-labor when he was in Massachusetts. He used the National Guard to put down a Boston police strike. He withdrew troops from the Dominican Republic in 1924, but sent Marines to Nicaragua as part of a U.S. gunboat diplomacy. He did nothing about prohibition. And, well, the list goes on. What do you want to take on?
Oh, so many things there to say. I'm just dizzy. I think he cared nothing about the people, just money. We got to that before, but it's so important to get back to it. Coolidge did say, not the business of America's business, but the chief business of America's business. But in the same speech, he said, chief ideal of America is idealism, not money. He saw these together. The money helped us to be good families, to be spiritual, to enjoy life, to be free, to serve God. I'm quite a religious man. So to take that first quote, it's a little bit out of context. When someone praises business that, and even calls it central, it doesn't mean they care about anything else. We need some context for that speech. That was made to the American Society of Newspaper Editors. On the issue of the Boston police strike, it's very interesting with lots of ramifications for the state of Wisconsin. Coolidge, let's just say the case, there were Boston policemen. They were underpaid. They were Irish Americans. They were lovable. They deserved a raise. They deserved better station houses. There were rats in their station houses chewing on their leather helmets. They were Coolidge's constituents. He was famous for getting the ethnic vote, which at that time was Irish American. He had an election coming up, so people sort of expected when these policemen went on strike in 1919 that the governor, and that's what he was by a peculiarity of Massachusetts law, the governor is in charge of the Boston police force, basically through a commissioner at that time, that he would reconcile. The governor Coolidge would go to the policemen and they would have a meeting, and they were joining a union. All right, it wasn't a communist union, it was just the AFL, and let's make a deal, they deserve the money. But when these nice policemen, remember, they're mounted policemen, so you imagine them separating from their horses, as in the Budweiser commercial, the horses whinnying after them on the street, the police horses, and walking off. When they left their office, there was chaos, riots, death, wounding in Boston. They had to call in the guard, a lot of guards. It was like a wartime situation. Coolidge was suddenly commander-in-chief of Massachusetts, clearing the streets and so on, putting up barbed wire, men with, I don't know, you know, bayonets going around. A wartime environment was terrible for Boston. And Coolidge fired the police as deserters. And he wrote a famous statement to Sam Gompers, the head of the AFL, with which they had affiliated, saying, there is no right to strike against the public safety by anyone, anywhere, any time. Was it terrible for the policemen? You bet. Did they miss them, their horses, and did their horses miss them? You bet. Did they find another job? Only with difficulty. This is also a foreshadowing, by the way, of Reagan's decision to fire the air traffic controllers, PATCO, but I do not discuss that in the book. Standing back, see that? So why was it good? How could it possibly be good? It was good because Coolidge drew a line in the sand. He's saying, we love public sector workers, but they cannot hold the rest of the economy, the rest of the cities, hostage. When we hire a public sector worker, it's different from an industrial worker. I'm not so sure they should have a strong union. That divides their loyalties. And because Coolidge did that, there were fewer public sector strikes across America in the 20s, and cities worked better. There was calm. There was prosperity. Of course, everyone wished to pay the police. There was prosperity, by the way, that facilitated raises for public sector workers like policemen.
And you don't
so
think
it's just a different solution.
There wasn't a possibility of working out a deal rather than firing all of them?
There was absolutely a possibility of working out a deal. There is always, but that facilitates, makes easier the next strike, doesn't it now? So if you negotiate with unions over and over again, you set the path for, you give them the opportunity to be more and more demanding, and there comes a point when the government can't pay anymore. It can't handle such a disruptive strike. So the boldness of Coolidge, who did, by the way, win his election after doing something that, you know, was so difficult. He liked the policemen. They liked him. He thought he would lose the election. Now, the boldness of Coolidge was he did something difficult to send a signal for the whole country as a governor. And one reason I realized only in writing this book and researching it why what Coolidge did was so important. Wilson, the actual sitting president, was kind of waffling on this issue. You know, he had his own, you know, possibility of strike. Everywhere workers wanted to strike because there was inflation and the government was lying about it. Just as now, prices were going up, but we weren't calling it inflation. So Wilson was waffling on the very same issue. And when Coolidge, a governor from a state, happened to draw a line in the sand, happened to be strong, Wilson said, oh, my gosh, you're right. Wilson endorsed what Coolidge did. And the country saw that this governor, this guy from Massachusetts, not very tall, kind of sandy, pretty silent, had upstaged a sitting president, and that he was taking the lead for the nation. And that's what Coolidge himself acknowledged. That's what gave him national stature, the stature to run for vice president.
Let's go to Erlyn and Nina. Hi, Erlyn.
Hi. I have always heard a rumor in my family, on my mother's side, that Calvin Coolidge acquired Rob Roy while in Oshkosh. Now, Rob Roy, of course, is the white collie who was originally named Oshkosh. And I think he acquired him through Stephen Radford, Jr., of Oshkosh, who was a family friend of my grandmother who helped to raise the dog. But we'd never been able to substantiate that.
That is such a great question. Oh, my gosh. Rob Roy was an important doggie for the president. He loved Rob Roy. He was a white collie, and I will research that for you. They favored white collies, they also favored Wisconsin. You know there were Coolidges in Wisconsin. The beginning of this book is about an ancestor in the Coolidge family who was rotting in prison because of a debt, somehow got out in Vermont and went to Wyocena, Wisconsin. There are brewers who are relatives of the Coolidges in Wisconsin as well. I don't have the charts in front of me. So when the Coolidges went to Wisconsin, I know Coolidge did pay money to upgrade the graves of some of his relatives in Wisconsin, brewers, people related to his grandmother. And he had a big fondness for Wisconsin. And when Rob Roy died, it was so terrible. It was toward the end of the presidency. President Coolidge was very sad. And there's material in his autobiography about the death of Rob Roy, who had a famous bark.
Hmm.
So Will, I'm going to try and help you find the answer to that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Erlyn. We'll let you know. We'll work that out somehow. Let's go to Kathy in Hammond. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess I'm getting more incredulous as this, the longer this author speaks. It's nice that she's bringing up all these details about Mrs. Coolidge's beautiful clothes and the nice doggies. I think she's failing to mention that the presidency of Coolidge was considered the third greatest failure in history after Grant and Harding. His hands-off of government led to an economic boom, runaway speculation, and the greatest economic depression in American history. Millions lost their jobs, homes, and life savings. This is just the most ridiculous rewriting of history I've ever heard.
Amity.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. You could talk to me directly. It's okay. The stuff that we learn in school, and I went to school too, tends to put Coolidge down. I just looked yesterday and saw some cliff notes where they basically gave the same resume you did of the 20s. That's what they teach in school.
Because it's the past.
But it might not be totally right. I've spent my whole career writing an economic. Can I just say this, and then you can reply? It might not be totally right. Just because something follows something doesn't mean it was caused by it. First, as we know through logic.
Yes.
The economic data for the 20s are extremely sound. They had productivity gains. They had low unemployment. The stock market went too high, but there was no inflation to speak of in the rest of the economy. And
right,
Coolidge did not
lack
believe
regulation of Wall Street.
Right. Well, there's often speculation of Wall Street. What about, for example, the
lack
Clinton?
Of
could I just
wait,
finish
wait.
And then you could talk? The Clinton speculation of Wall Street. Coolidge didn't like Wall Street going that high, but at that time it wasn't the job of the federal government to be in charge. It was actually New York State that was in
well,
charge of the stock market.
Well, it actually was.
I'll stop now, but the point is there is plenty of evidence, and it's a shame it's not taught in school.
Go ahead, Kathy.
It's not correct. I'm sorry. I can't sit here. I used to teach history, and I just cannot sit here and listen to somebody just rewriting the facts. It's absurd.
All right, Kathy, thanks very much for your call. So you're saying that Calvin Coolidge economic policies were just fine and did not precipitate the Great Depression at all? What did then?
Oh, let's not force it into black and white. This is a multi-causal, not a one or two causer. I wrote in Forgotten Man. Coolidge is the prequel to a book about what caused the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote that one, and thank goodness, and thanks for many readers, it's been a national bestseller for a long time. The Forgotten Man book says there were five causes of the Great Depression. Well, I'll back up and say, the stock market crashed all the time in our history, dramatically, 20, 30, 40%. It had never happened before that the stock market, or at least not in a long, long time, that the stock market was followed by an 11-year depression. And by depression, when we define depression, what do we mean? We mean double-digit unemployment. That's why we remember the depression, because it was long and there was double-digit unemployment most of the time. High double-digit unemployment. So Coolidge had no reason to believe a great national depression of 11 years would follow this rise, because he'd seen the stock market go up before and go down and have maybe a short downturn, a sharp one, but no 11 years, 10 years, 9 years, 8 years of double-digit, right? What made that depression great, as I argue in Forgotten Man, were basically too many government interventions, starting with Hoover, a Republican, who did things such as the following, and this will make sense to any employer today. He said, you must keep wages high so that your employee will shop and make the economy get strong again. And that sounds nice, but as an employer, when your money that's coming in, your profits, or even the cash flowing in is down, you're in a bind when a chief executive says that to you. And, of course, what you do if you want to obey the president, and Hoover was hard to disobey, is you keep the wages high for those you keep on staff, and you don't rehire, and maybe you lay off, right? And that was a new thing for the United States. Formerly, employers had dropped wages when they saw profits drop, but laid off less easily. It's a trade-off, right? Everyone knows this as an employer. So that was one thing, which I had never known about, and which is studied by the scholar Lee Ohanian and another scholar, Harold Cole, the labor effect. And of course, Roosevelt went along and did the same thing, insisting people hire, make rules, or rather pay high wages, make rules about it. You can see minimum wage laws and so on. And that made the labor market difficult. It made hiring hard, and it contributed to unemployment throughout the decade, such laws. And we've all written about this quite a bit before. Another factor was a tariff, the so-called Smoot-Hawley tariff, which Hoover signed, and Coolidge would have endorsed. He didn't happen to have signed it, but he would have endorsed it, albeit, with some qualms. Coolidge basically believed he must support tariffs because his party did, but you can see in his letters arguing with all his friends, this was a topic of discussion for them. Anyway, that tariff hurt the rest of the world, and the rest of the world suffered, and that hurt our markets. Another factor was the general intrusion of government on the part of the Roosevelt administration, where they basically took over everything, the federal government, and that, in Forgotten Man, I argue, kept it going. So at every year, you want to ask, what's keeping the depression going this year? And it's different things. Another factor, monetary. Of course, we've all written about this extensively. There was deflation. the money actually literally ran out. People made their own money in some places, including probably Wisconsin and Michigan. So to blame all this on Coolidge is a little far. When Coolidge announced he wouldn't run again, the stock market was not at 381, the top high. And he watched with alarm as it rose. But in our culture at that point, the chief executive wasn't in charge of that. And he wasn't sure that the government should always manage the economy. It might set a bad precedent. I'm aware that this isn't taught this way. I know what schools are. I teach at NYU, and we have four children who go to school. At all stages, but in the economic field, the consideration is changing, and it might be fun to go and have a look at how we've changed, how we view the 30s in the past 10 or 20 years.
So you would say that Coolidge is perhaps a rising star. His stock is going up.
Oh, no, I would say if he were a stock, he would be a buy. I don't know if it's going up, but he has value for the value investors, because what he did wasn't wrong. The central fallacy today in economics and in our discussion is that the government spending creates growth, and that comes out of the GDP concept that we have, which comes out of post-war economics. But sometimes government spending doesn't create that much growth because it's not very creative. Often money flows to bridges to nowhere. That's one of the things Japan has taught us with its 10 waves of stimuli short of growth. And sometimes government spending gets in the way of private spending, or the government is like, you know, a bull in a china shop, the china shop being the economy. So you have the bull in the china shop, right? And it makes everybody pace themselves against the wall.
Let's go to more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is the author of Coolidge, Amity Schlaes. Our number is 800-486-8655. Amity directs the economic project at the Bush Center, the 4% Growth Project, teaches economics of the 30s in the MBA program at NYU, and is a former member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. She's written several other books as well. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls now. Dennis in Fox Lake. Hi, Dennis.
Hello. This is Dennis Moriarty, and I have some further information on Rob Roy. Our family raised him on their little farm from a puppy on until he got to be a little bit larger and went to the White House. So he was raised on a little farm north of Berlin on Highway 21, 40-some acres, and he was kept there with love and a lot of attention. And I have about six or seven pictures of him. I was always interested in how the connection was with the White House. Who made that connection? It must not have been my family. In the archives, there was a mention that the famous portrait of the First Lady in a red dress with Rob Roy, that the person that gave him or sent him Rob Roy was so interested, he sent him a copy of that portrait. And I've always been interested to find out who that person was.
Do you know, Amity?
I do not, and there's also Prudence Prim, who was another white collie. And I'm wondering if Rob Roy and Prudence were related. Prudence died in, I believe she died in South Dakota. But I have a suggestion. We have a discussion on my author Facebook page of a lot of facts. If you email me on Facebook, I will post the information you have and any pictures in a respectful way, and we will go on the hunt to find more info about Rob Roy. I will also ask, I will also ask the archivists and see if we can find anything at the Forbes Memorial, Forbes Library, where they have some Coolidge material, at the Coolidge Foundation, of which I'm a trustee, Calvin Coolidge Memorial Foundation, and perhaps also in Barrie, Vermont, where there are some Coolidge papers. This is such a good story. Please send me an email, and I'll post it.
Yeah,
and then all the Coolidge scholars, including Dave Petrugia, with whom I often work and who has focused on pets, will answer.
All right.
Thank you for helping us with the mystery.
Can you give me your email?
How about Amity Schlaes at Hotmail? Rob Roy died at Walter Reed.
Really?
Yeah.
And it's you spell her name A-M-I-T-Y-S-H-L-A-E-S. And thanks very much for the call. We have time for a couple more phone calls in a moment. What about the issue? There was a part of the book where you talked about dinner parties and they didn't have to worry about alcohol, which would be an, another expense because of prohibition. What were Calvin Coolidge's thoughts about prohibition, and why did he not advocate a repeal?
Very interesting. You know, politicians have to make choices about what they favor and what they do not. And, you know, what's important? What should you expend political capital on, and what maybe less? I think Coolidge put prohibition in the bother category, in the category he wasn't so sure was worth fighting for, but he was going to go along with it because it was the position of the government, it was the law of the land, and you know, many in his party were for it. He wasn't going to abuse the law by publicly drinking, which is slightly different from Harding, who did drink kind of visibly at the White House. They said people went to the White House for food and action under prohibition. Coolidge followed the rules, tried to ensure others did, at least when anyone was watching. But I did notice that he didn't understood that liquor was business. Many of his constituents had breweries or inns that were hurt by this snobby law, prohibition. You know, there was revenue to be had, and as an accountant, as a budgeteer, he appreciated that revenue and the commerce it came from, and saw there was an economic cost to prohibition. Also, that people tended to lose respect for the law. But once they saw people breaking the prohibition law, then generally they saw that maybe they could break other laws. So that offended him and his sense of good government. He did buy stock. I was going to say this was his mischief. He did buy stock in a company called Standard Brands, which sounds anodyne, but it contained a component of the yeast business, which is, of course, important for beer. And that was his way of going along on the idea that prohibition would be repealed.
Let's go to Nate Dennis. Thanks for your call in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I was actually going to say Coolidge deserves some bad points for the Great Depression. I do think he set up a situation that hit Hoover, but was brewing long before Hoover was president. You have problems with the agricultural sector. Also, the hands-off approach to the economy really ignored unemployment, and your guest mentioned that unemployment was something that marked the Great Depression, but New Deal spending was actually responsible for reducing unemployment. And if you look during the Great Depression and the New Deal, you do have decreasing unemployment before World War II started. On top of that, I think there's a possibility, and this is my own theory, that you might have diminishing returns, which is an economic theory I'm sure your guest knows of, with tax cuts where and removal of regulation, where the more effort you put into doing one thing, you get better at it and you get more return for it up to a certain point, and then it starts dropping and you're wasting time and energy. And I'm thinking potentially the more effort you put into cutting taxes, sure, you might get more return at one point, but you keep doing it, and at some point, all you're doing is actually costing the economy rather than benefiting it.
Amity.
Oh, such thoughtful questions, and several. One is employment. Does spending generate employment? What is the 20s and 30s record? And the other is about returns from tax cuts. Okay, so to get the first one, you can see, you know, there's two ways to look at something. One is how it changes, and that's what the caller was focusing on. And the other is simpler, what it is. In the 20s, unemployment was low. It was below 5%. While the government was pulling its hand back, unemployment was low. It's once in a while it would go up. You can see spots, but basically it was below 5%. That was good. In the 30s, unemployment was high. It was over 10%, sometimes 20. There's a big, wild fight about unemployment rates in the 30s. Some people think unemployment averaged 15% in the 30s, and some people think it averaged 13.8. That's the difference between terrible and awful. And even late in the 30s, not in the year of the war, but in 37, 38, you will see high double-digit unemployment, no matter whose data you use, including, for example, that of Christy Romer, who was with the administration recently. So it's a choice, in my view, and I appreciate the question, between double-digit or under 5. And the evidence suggests that because of the long correlation of the bigger government or less government, that maybe less government, if you look at these periods, went together with lower unemployment.
And we have to stop, Amity, we're out of time, so we need to stop here. But thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for that thoughtful question.
Amity Schles, her book is Coolidge, and we thank her for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production. We heard the stock market being mentioned a couple times, and it's been in the news, of course, with a record high. Tomorrow, David K. Johnston will be joining us, one of our guests, who looks at why that can be so high with so many people hurting. Great conversations ahead.